The fourth part of the interview with Jack Nichols took place in Oakland, California on June 30th, 1988.
Now, at our last meeting, you talked about congressional delegations that traveled to Iran from time to time. Now, which members of Congress did you find particularly helpful or sympathetic to administration policy on Iran during the course of the 70s?
I would say understanding. Helpful is perhaps not quite the word I would use. Uh-huh. Understanding. Let's see. I think Lee Hamilton understood, had a grasp of, although he didn't always agree necessarily, but I think he understood this situation anyhow, and made considerable effort to understand. He was one member. What was the fellow from senator from Connecticut, one of the eastern states, who's since retired. More noted for his involvement with the Arab-Israeli.
Not Javits.
No, not Javits. Yeah. Although Javits had come to Iran, I didn't have any distinct impression one way or another of his, excuse me, his attitude toward the administration's policies in Iran. Tell you the truth, I remember the ones in opposition, and rather vehement opposition, more clearly than I do those that that seem to have some understanding of the situation.
Who are among the more effective critics of the policy that you encountered?
Effective
or knowledgeable, perhaps.
Well, I didn't find an awful lot of people all that knowledgeable. Now, Chuck Percy was certainly one that was knowledgeable and was helpful, I would say, insofar as the administration's policy toward Iran is concerned. Who else?
Hunter Carter and the Republicans? Hunter Carter and Ford Nixon?
Yeah, it was throughout the 70s. Throughout the 70s. Who else? I'm sorry, the names don't come to me right now.
As we met last time, you mentioned that Richard Helms and William J. Casey visited Tehran together at one point. Do you remember the circumstances of the other visit, particularly?
No. I remember they came up by the embassy, and I suppose as much to say hello to me as uh-huh. as anything. I was not. They didn't ask for anything. But as far as I know, it was just more. Bringing themselves up to date on what was going on there. Dick, by that time, had his own, as I recall, had his own consultancy company or enterprise. I guess it's an enterprise of one, basically. But other than that, no, I don't recall.
Private business. I've also read that in the spring or late winter of 78, George Bush and Ronald Reagan made visits to Iran. Do you remember?
When was this?
Sometime in the late winter or spring of 78, George Bush and then Ronald Reagan made visits to Iran, you know, separately, I guess. Do you recall anything about that?
I do not remember those at all.
Yeah. Okay. Now, get back to the, some of the questions we were dealing with.
Reagan?
Yeah.
78?
Yeah. That's, I was looking at some of the captured documents they mentioned. There's minutes of an embassy staff meeting, and they mentioned that Bush and Reagan were in town or would be in town sometime.
The spring? That was
thereabouts. Thereabouts, yeah.
Because I was there until May.
Yeah.
I certainly don't remember it.
I guess they mentioned that Margaret Thatcher was also coming in the same amount of time frame. Mm-hmm. They joked about it being a conservative conclave being held in Tehran. But, okay. Now, what did you... You said you left for Washington in the spring of... May of 78?
May.
Yes. What was your assessment of the political situation around the time that you left the country?
Well, I hate to keep sounding like a broken record, but that's... what it was that I've said many times before, basically that the situation, not unexpectedly, was turbulent, but I thought manageable.
Okay.
And as a matter of fact, this is what I told Lee Hamilton when I went up to see him in an informal way. This wasn't a formal hearing or anything like that. It was just somebody back from Iran. He was interested in what was going on, always was interested, and I went up and talked to him about how I saw things. And as I recall, this was very much the tenor, if not the exact words, of my conversation with him.
Now, what was your new assignment in Washington?
As the Deputy Assistant Secretary for Near East and South Asian Affairs. But my responsibilities did not include Iran.
How would you describe them?
Well, it was the responsibility for the area, the subcontinent, if you will. India, Pakistan, Afghanistan, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, the Seychelles, where else? Nepal.
There was another deputy assistant secretary, wasn't there?
There are three deputies.
Okay.
There are three deputies. One was... And that was Bill Crawford. He was responsible for Iran on to the west. And then a third was sort of North Africa.
And Harold Saunders was your Iran?
Hal Saunders.
Hal Saunders was your Iran?
He was the assistant secretary, right.
So you did no work on Iran in the following months, basically, or
was take your pardon?
Did you do any work on Iran in the following months?
Not on a sustained basis. And naturally, I was I tried to keep informed on all that was going on in the Near East and South Asian area. All of the deputies did. I mean, because we sometimes overlap with the response, having to fill in or something like that, and. As I say, from time to time, I would meet with people outside of the department that wanted my opinion on Iran. Matter of fact, I think that at one stage included Jim Bill, as an example. Some congressional people. I did, when things started to get increasingly difficult, I did fill in for Bill Crawford on a Senate Foreign Relations Committee meeting.
Yeah, I've read about the Jew and Henry Fuck test flight together.
Yeah, which was a rather unhappy experience on both sides. But
what kind of that stage was in September, I think, of
78? Something like that, yeah.
What was your outlook at that stage? Any difference than a few months earlier?
Yes, it was changing. In other words, it was obvious that it was becoming much more serious than I had felt it was when I left. Although I still sustained the belief that events were manageable. Now, you know, in hindsight, I have to say. Not trying to defend myself per se, but one thing we didn't know was that the Shah was quite ill, and I think that had an impact on how events unfolded. Another thing was that he had lost his closest, up till that time, closest advisors, Alam One, what was in the head of the, Dr. Not Ebtihaj. Again, his names. But anyhow, people who had been with him back in the dark days of 60, 59, 60, 61, 62, who he had relied on heavily for advice and counsel, well, they were gone. And there isn't really anybody around like that anymore. It's sort of outgrown everybody else, as it were. So I think that was a factor. There were, of course, many others, but...
Now, you said that the senators were unhappy with your fixed account of what was going on, or how did they...
Well, I can recall Javits, for example, saying, in effect, why isn't the United States Sixth Fleet sort of in the Persian Gulf right about now? And that's the kind of, rhetoric that's hard to address.
So he thought you and Pike were being too calm about the situation? Or?
Well, I think he thought that the State Department, in effect he was saying, what is the Secretary of State concerned about this? Is he focused on this? And I kept saying, he's well informed. And this coincided, of course, with the intense the Camp David Peace Accord exercise negotiations. This was all going on at the same time, and obviously Vance was heavily preoccupied and involved with this, as was many other senior officials of the administration, senior officials in the sense of those dealing with foreign affairs. There was some impatience and also a feeling that we really hadn't the insights that they felt we ought to have on what was going on there. Now, again, since I wasn't involved with it on a day-to-day basis, I felt a little defensive about that, unfortunately. I think there were some stories about they were mad, although I didn't get that hostility. I remember John Glenn was saying, well, I'd known him from before, slightly. I mean, we're not buddies, but he was sympathetic to my, what was obviously a difficult position. And so were some of the others. I mean, they weren't hostile.
The Javits made the strongest statement.
That I remember.
Yeah.
Sam Nunn was, questions were more sympathetic. I can't remember who all was around the table, but it was not a hostile meeting. It was, I can't recall whether it was full or not, but there were unusual number of senators for that kind of a meeting, unusual number of senators present.
I was wondering if it was a subcommittee or a full committee.
Yeah.
Be that as it may.
Yeah.
Now, according to one of the captured documents from the embassy, did you visit Iran again in the fall, October? Did you visit Iran again in the fall, late October of 78?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But there was... although I was not officially responsible for it, this basically was, I forget whether it was coming or going, but it was on my way to my area of responsibility.
So how long did you stop?
Just a day and a half or something like that, if that.
Did you spend any time with Ambassador Sullivan? Or?
Yeah, oh yes. Yeah. Well, they kind of put me up at the Chancellery, at his residence. But it wasn't... as I say, I didn't have any message per se or anything like that.
Did he explain his outlook at that stage?
Yes. I don't remember whether this was... I remember Bill showing me a cable that he'd written that he was about to send back to Washington.
Thinking the applicable?
And I don't remember whether, you know, as I look back on it, whether that was the thinking the unthinkable cable or it was something else, but close to that.
Because I guess by early November, or even late October, he was concluding that the Shah position was near hopeless.
Mm-hmm.
And it was necessary to search for political alternatives to the Shah. Did he talk about that?
Now you've reminded me. I did, let's see, how many... I guess I spent maybe 2 to 3 days there. And because I did know some of the personalities, Bill and I talked about alternatives. Again, I don't recall precisely what it was in the context of thinking the unthinkable, but that was certainly on his mind, because I remember going to see Jamshid Muzaggar to inquire about, not about alternatives per se, but his evaluation or judgment, whatever you want to say, about certain opposition people, including Bakhtiar, whether he, as an old friend, not as an official, he was of course no longer prime minister at that time, but whether he could give me his frank feelings about some of these people, and
including Bakhtiar,
if they were to capable of inspiring a support and some kind of a coalition effort to bring order to what was rapidly deteriorating into anarchy, if not civil war.
What did he think? How was your think? To the best of your recollection.
I don't. The names that I mentioned, and I can't remember all of them, I remember Bakhtiar as one, but there were some others. And Jamshid was understandably fairly careful about what he said. My overall impression, however, was that he found it difficult to see a viable coalition being led by some of the people that I mentioned, or indeed a viable coalition emerging. And this was in the context, in part, of just the Persian character of being unable, people being unable to collaborate and cooperate with each other on a sustained basis. I mean, that was part of it, I think.
Uh-huh. Did you meet anybody else besides Muzaggar that you recall?
In that specific context. I saw a number of them, but none that I posed that kind of question to, or those kinds of questions.
What kind of thinking did you encounter among the various people you met about the situation generally?
Well, obviously some unease and uncertainty, and always the question of what does the United States think about this, or what do you think about it? But meaning the U.S. government in many cases, and what are you going to do about it? That sort of thing.
Did you see much of Tehran when you were there, or did you pretty much just stay in the embassy? Or?
Not much. And it was not a very extended period. It may have been 2 days at the most.
Did this visit lead to any rethinking on your part of the extent to which the crisis is still manageable, or?
To be honest, I don't know that I gave it any deep thought one way or another. I had my own concerns and responsibilities, and I was off paying attention to those.
Well, saying in general, what did you think the Shaw's chances of political survival were about this stage?
This is, as a matter of fact, as I recall, it was the end of October, maybe even Halloween or something like that. I think I was still persuaded that he could survive. It was clear that he had to do more than he was doing or had done. I personally wasn't convinced that a national front coalition was viable. In other words, I would share Jamshid's pessimism in that extent, to the extent that he expressed it himself that way. I would have agreed with him. But I think the question in my mind was whether a more vigorous and rigid repression of dissidents would have not brought the desired results, and whether the Shah was going to be forced to that by what was going on or not, I wasn't clear. He had remarked to Bill at one stage, and I don't remember, Bill Sullivan, that he wasn't going to have Iran's youth die to save the kingdom or the kingship, save himself, if you will. I mean, he just, that was not within his realm of options. And I think he sincerely felt very strongly about that. In other words, somebody else might well have had the troops out a lot earlier and been a lot more brutal about it, and it may have come out to a different result, but that was not to be.
Apparently, like Brzezinski, the Tennessee was arguing in his favor more or less of a so-called iron fist policy. Was there much discussion at the State Department of that, promoting that in some way, or?
Not in my hearing. I'm pretty sure it was discussed, and probably with the Secretary or with Warren Christopher, and it was certainly, I learned subsequently, the tenor of messages that went out to Tehran, to Bill Sullivan.
Stressing that option, or stressing that point?
Yeah. I think so, yeah. Yes. Yeah. I think Bill talks about that in his book.
That's right. Yeah. Well, what point did you conclude the Shah had no chance of political survival? Our president of the Republic, a consensus forming in state that this was the case. When was that consensus formed?
Well, I suppose late November, beginning of December. It was pretty hard to argue that the game wasn't rapidly approaching a conclusion. I can't say that everybody felt that way, but as I say, it was increasingly difficult to argue the other way, that certainly nobody was saying that, look, everything's peachy keen. It's perfectly clear that it wasn't peachy keen, but I mean, for example, I don't recall at what point Brzezinski concluded that the game was lost. He may not have concluded that right up to the day that Sean left, or within a matter of several days. But I don't know.
Yeah, I think he becomes more of a concern about pulling the armed forces together to as a basis for some kind of stability.
Yeah. Then came the famous
Heiser mission,
and
now, of course, late in the year, Shaw appointed Bakhtiar as prime minister. Was that in any way a result of Sullivan's suggestion or positive support for Bakhtiar as an alternative?
I don't really know how the Shah reached his decision to have Bakhtiar appointed, or to appoint Bakhtiar as his prime minister. As I recall, and here again, you really have to rely on other people's memories and memoirs. And I think Bill said in his book that the matter of doing something on the political front was obviously a subject of conversation between him and the Shah. Shah wanted to know what the United States felt, and but I don't know that any personalities per se were mentioned. We had long held, and those in the embassy when I was there, or even back before that, back in Washington, always held that if we had ever mentioned anybody's name, that was almost certain kiss of death. I mean, you just
for that particular individual.
Right.
Yeah. Now, after the Shah left in mid-January, and Bakhtiar pushes Bakhtiar out of power, I guess some analysts of the State Department, like Frick, among others, argued that Khomeini and religious leadership would more or less stay in the background and let the moderate revolutionaries rule in the coming period. To what extent did you share that assumption, that people like Vozvodnik could rule and let the religious leadership would stay in the background, not trying to govern themselves, not trying to play a role in the government as such?
Well, I don't recall with any great precision that debate. I know it went on. Again, I was, you know, I had my own responsibilities and preoccupations. To the extent that I can recall what I thought about things at all, I thought that basically this was going to lead to anarchy. I expected, as a matter of fact, a resurgence of regional differences and conflict. Obviously, I was wrong. At least I was wrong about it, the way it was dealt with, which was a very brutal suppression. I mean, as brutal as anything that the Shah or his predecessors had indulged in. But, you know, as to whether they were going to stay in the background and let the civilians, the entrenched bureaucrats run things, I don't recall. I had an opinion one way or another.
Did you do any work on Iran during the course of 79?
No.
It was pretty much, you were just focusing on your other,
right,
on your regional responsibilities.
That's right.
So when did you leave the State Department then? 80?
80.
Yeah. And you went to the Army War College, the National War College?
Well, I didn't. Yeah. Let's see, 79, 80, mid 80, I went over to the National Defense University for, what was it? Let me come out here. It's 70, I'm sorry. I'm getting my years. Mid 79, I left my responsibilities in state and went over to National Defense University, and spent a year there, where I researched what I had written, what I eventually wrote, and participated in some seminars and that sort of thing to do. I was a senior research associate there. And then I retired.
Do you have any concluding comments you want to make on the, on Iran? Or I have a wrap-up question I prepared. I could answer that.
Why don't you ask the question?
Well, okay. Now, some analysts, like Professor Jane Gills, among others, have argued the U.S. experience in Iran during the post-war era was a failure, in the sense it was a failure of intelligence and a failure of policy. For example, Bill argues that there was a policy failure because the policymakers began with a mistaken premise that the Shah was basically invulnerable and had complete control of Iran. And he also argues that there was sort of an intelligence failure because the U.S. did not adequately understand internal political and cultural conditions in Iran. These failures were interrelated, in a sense, he's arguing. To what extent would you agree with that overall argument?
Well, I don't accept Bill's premise that, one, we didn't understand internal situation in Iran. We did not foresee, it's perfectly true. The Ayatollah and the mullahs ascending to power, but I don't think James Bill did either. Insofar as a policy failure was concerned, I would argue quite strongly the opposite, that I would say overall our policy vis-a-vis Iran was a very successful one. We established a close and viable relationship with an important country in that part of the world and sustained that relationship from 1946 until 1980. That's hardly a policy favor in my book, anyhow. Now that it came to the end that it did, I think has a great deal more to do with historical forces and trends than anything to do with U.S. policy vis-a-vis Iran. And I really quite resent the implication, I don't think you meant it quite that way, but that as a consequence of U.S. policy, this is what happened in Iran. This is utter nonsense.
I'm just trying to recount his basic argument.
Yeah.
I simplified it a bit. But.
Yeah, well, you know, as I say, and it's not just Jim, but there have been another brothers, and everybody's saying, mm-hmm. You see, I told you so. Well, if you keep saying, like, we're going to have an earthquake in California, sooner or later we're going to have an earthquake in California, and then everybody says, see, I told you so. I mean, nonsense. Some of these things are just inevitable. I don't say that in the detail it has to be inevitable, but it is inevitable. Haile Selassie sooner or later had to go. And the king of Libya sooner or later had to go. I mean, this is just part of the historical evolution of societies in the world. And you might even argue that maybe the United States has seen its peak for a while and we're now in decline. There's a book by the boys of Mr. Kennedy. I gather I haven't read his book. I just read excerpts from it, but it makes a pretty persuasive case that maybe we've had it, and it's somebody else's turn now. So, you know, I mean, pointing figures and saying these are somebody's fault or failure is, I'm sorry, just nonsense.
Okay, I have nothing more to say. Okay. Thanks very much for your time.
You're certainly welcome, Bill. Okay.